So, from 1983, that was Tears for Fears. I don't think you need to be told the title of that song. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. An abortive US attack on oil-rich Venezuela, an act of war, like regular Israeli acts of war now bombing Syria. But these attempts of our so-called allies to start wars, which are going on regularly now, these war crimes are going virtually unreported in the London media. That's why we're here, folks. Germany also issues what some have called a declaration of war, a very different type of declaration against the European Central Bank. What does this mean for the much-needed Eurozone bailouts and the EU's future? And the BBC. The news reports a dawn chorus day last weekend, but not International Press Freedom Day. Was their former employee George Orwell right about the BBC being the Ministry of Truth, a clear and present danger to the nation? And the real VE Day behind the BBC hype, betrayal and victory on the 8th of May 1945. First, the atomic bomb. Evidence emerging over the last 3 years or so through official documents and discovery of radioactive material in Germany that the Nazis tested an atomic bomb in October 1944 near the town of Ludwigslust, 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July 1945. Then the deals done by Churchill, Roosevelt and Truman for $1 billion in looted wealth for Nazi-enriched uranium, for experimental data from barbaric human testing, all carried out through the working of to death of human prisoners, Hitler's so-called Untermensch. And the greatest betrayal of all, perhaps, the aid given by the Allied leaders to a covert financial Fourth Reich of banksters and transnational corporations, the SS in suits in their supporters, an international mafia, directing an international NATO Bilderberg operation even unto this day, some say. And finally, on VE Day, whatever happened to Winston Churchill's finest hour speech about Britain standing up to the threat of Christian civilization, when Christians can now be prosecuted through the British courts for practicing what they preach? Anyway, we'll start this week with Martin. If you want to just relate to us some of the things you've been digging out, you've been emailing me during the week. What about some of the stories that you've picked up which you think throw particular light on what's really been going on over the last 7 days?
Well, you mentioned earlier the Bay of Piglets incident in Venezuela, where several people have been killed. Ex-US Special Forces mercenaries have been captured. Pompeo said that the US government were not directly involved, but of course they'd put a $15 million, I believe, price on the head of Nicolas Maduro, the elected head of Venezuela.
It's a sort of bounty.
Yeah. And
wanted dead or alive. This sounds like something from a Wild West movie.
It does, and it's fairly clear that US intelligence were behind this operation, but they wanted it to be plausibly deniable. But of course, as the Venezuelans say, what if we were to send commandos to the US to try and seize your president? That would be regarded as an act of war, wouldn't it?
Because it is. Well, almost fascinating.
Well, indeed. And of course, this is in the middle of a coronavirus crisis, which is supposedly, the top of everybody's agenda. And both Venezuela and Iran have approached the IMF for loans in order to help them deal with the problems. And they've been told that they can't have them, and that all maximum pressure to try and get regime change in Venezuela and Iran are still on the books. So if anybody was thinking that the coronavirus was going to lead to a situation where everybody would ease up on the warmongering, then they'd be completely wrong.
Well,
it's quite clear that the US is determined to push the advantage here.
They say you never let a good crisis go to waste. Are there any other things that have been going on this week you think that where some of the more powerful people in the world have been using this coronavirus as an opportunity to get away with stuff they might otherwise have had to face more scrutiny for?
Well, I mean, obviously the main thing that's been floating out there this week in relation to the main story, the coronavirus story, is this leak to the Murdoch press in Australia of a supposedly secret document which supposedly proves that the virus originated in the laboratory in Wuhan, which of course is exactly what Trump and his electoral strategist is going to try and push now. He's going to try and be re-elected as President of the United States on a China caused the virus platform. Interestingly enough, there seems to be tension between whoever leaked this and the actual intelligence services in the West, you know, the MI6, NSA. They basically have come out and, you know, through anonymous spokespeople to The Guardian, for example, saying, well, this isn't our material. So what's happened is somebody in the US government has leaked this to try and blacken the name of the Chinese, but they haven't cleared it with the intelligence services.
Well, it's interesting that you should say this happened in Australia, because, I mean, I've just come back from the Antipodes from New Zealand, and I can tell you it's a very different attitude to China there. I think that they are nervous, very nervous, about the idea that China could extend its power in the Pacific and that Australia and New Zealand could be easy meat. Now, do you think there's any justification whatsoever for the New Zealanders and the Australians to be more afraid of China than, say, for example, we are here in Europe?
Well, I think the problem for all nations in the Pacific is that the Chinese are there to stay, and they're developing a massive economy. I mean, Australia's main trading partner, the people who buy their exports, which are things like coal and iron, that is China. And Australia basically shrugged off the financial crisis in 2008 because the Chinese rebooted their economy, and the Australians are basically intimately integrated into the Chinese economy. So it's all very well for them to fear China, but basically China is what puts the food on the table in Australia and New Zealand.
Let's cut to the chase, because surely if there were a world war broke out, it's quite feasible that Australia and New Zealand would just be easy meat. China would occupy them very, very
quickly. You're mixing it up with World War II. If a war breaks out between China and the West, it'll all be fought in the South China Sea. That's where it'll happen. It's not the Chinese aren't going to surge out of China into Australia, which is in fact quite a long way away from them. What will happen, of course, in Australia, if there's any kind of break with China, is that the Australian economy will collapse because they're dependent upon Chinese demand to run their economy. And New Zealand is an even smaller economy, and they're very much dependent on what happens out elsewhere. So, of course, for cultural reasons, Australia and New Zealand are very much in the pocket of the Yanks and the British. And if the Yanks and the British want a war with China, no doubt, as in World War I and World War II, they will obediently line up, even though it's not in their interests. Ultimately, I mean, John Pilger produced a very good documentary about this some years ago now, The Coming War on China. And he's an Australian by origin. And, of course, he's very well aware of these kind of tensions. It creates massive schizophrenia in both countries because culturally they are, and particularly Australia, very much in the Western camp. But at the same time, they're very much economically dependent on China. They don't sell much to the US or to Britain.
Well, we had International Press Freedom Day last weekend, and although you wouldn't necessarily know it, well, you wouldn't know it by watching BBC News. They didn't say anything about it at all, deciding instead to concentrate on International Dawn Chorus Day, whatever that is. I think it's just been invented as some sort of gimmick. But anyway, this is one tension with Australia, Martin, isn't it? That as an Australian citizen, Julian Assange is actually very, very well respected in Australia, very well understood over there. His work as a journalist has been very much appreciated by Australians. And yet here is Britain potentially about to extradite Assange to the United States for a crime. Well, what crime? No crime whatsoever. So this could actually be an enormous rift potentially between us and the Australians.
Well, I think the Australian media have been very strong in supporting the songs, like the equivalent of the NUJ and so on. The Australian government, the Morrison government, is essentially a puppet government for the US, and they have done nothing to protect him. And that's caused a scandal in Australia in more liberal circles, if you like. The five eyes that the people talk about, you know, Britain, the US, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, they are the core of the anti-Chinese, anti-Russian coalition. And of course the intelligence services are the key, and they're the linkages. And of course the politicians, in New Zealand, for example, don't necessarily control their own intelligence services, which are run by the British and the Americans.
But what about in Britain? Do the politicians control the British intelligence, MI5, no. 6, etc.?
I don't think they do. I think in actual fact, the intelligence infrastructure is part of the deep state, which answers partly only to itself, but also to powerful oligarchic interests, which basically run all of our societies under a facade of democracy.
Well, anyway, so we're not going to ignore International Press Freedom Day, that's for sure, even though we are ourselves a show that is begging the managing editor of BCFM to let us back on FM. We don't think that what we're doing is breaking any Ofcom rules or guidelines, and certainly I, personally, am prepared to defend anything and put my time and effort into defending any complaints. So any of our listeners would like to urge the BCFM management to allow us back on FM, if Ofcom would like to, then please do. You know, that would be very helpful. But on Press Freedom Day, we are obviously in a situation ourselves where we're not broadcasting on FM anymore. Supposedly, that's all because of the COVID-19 virus, but you know, as I say, I don't think we're breaking any Ofcom guidance. But let's listen now to what the now criminalised, actually potentially jailed for several years, former ambassador to Uzbekistan, who lost his job because he refused to condone torture in Uzbekistan. His name's Craig Murray. He's a Scottish nationalist, and here he is a week or so ago talking about what he calls the torture of Julian Assange, one of the most important investigative journalists and publishers in the world.
The torture of Julian Assange and the extreme conditions in which he's being held, his mistreatment in Belmarsh jail, his being confined to a glass box, to a large extent, they're doing it because they can, and they're doing it to show us that they can, to demonstrate the power of the state and to make us afraid. That fear is obviously particularly aimed at Tristan, for example, because it's meant to terrify Tristan about what's liable to happen to him and to the other people in WikiLeaks if WikiLeaks continues its work. It's a demonstration of, it's an act of terror. It's designed to terrify us into stopping opposition to the security state and to terrify us into never again releasing evidence of war crimes. And I think when you look at the sheer malicious, the malign way that the judge Vanessa Bereitsa is conducting the court, and several of us here have been in the court, and all of us, I think, have just been absolutely stunned by the relentless and remorseless hostility of the judges and of the court, and the lack of even the appearance of civility that normally cloaks the horror of state violence that lies behind court proceedings. All that is an act of terror. It's an act designed to terrify us out of resistance, and that is the purpose of it.
Martin, I mean, this is really, some people might suggest that what Craig Murray's doing there is undermining the role of the court, but he's pointing out that actually the judge in this case has not acted in a balanced or fair manner towards Julian Assange. So it's absolutely right that someone speaks out when observing that. And he, of course, has been sitting there himself in the court and seen this directly.
Well, that's right. And of course, there's also questions about conflict of interest with the judges who have links to people who are benefiting from the military industrial complex and are quite high up in the deep state. And this is all going on. Most people are ignoring it. They've just forgotten all about it. The alternative media are picking up on it. And as Craig Murray points out, the message for the alternative media, for people like us, is look what we can do and you can't stop us. Meanwhile, the rest of the world obviously is turning its head away and doesn't even know what's going on because they've been plenty of other things to think about.
Well, we've also heard this week that Julian Assange's case has been put off for several months. I think it's October or September that it's going to be actually taking place. This is seen by his defence team as a victory, Martin, I suppose, in that it's only going to delay the process. But actually, of course, for Julian Assange himself, this is just longer and longer. He's got to wait for any kind of semblance of justice in a system which doesn't seem to believe in justice.
Yeah, well, I mean, I take on board what the defence team asked for this September date, and they seem to have got it because the US people who are in the court agreed to it. The British were prepared to just go along with what they'd originally planned. So, I mean, this is probably one of the most important court cases in the world today. Even though, as I said earlier, the mainstream media are largely ignoring it, the implications of it are enormous. And I think, as we are here in England, the home of Magna Carta, this is actually a complete defiance of English common law. He hasn't committed any offence in English common law. We have no Espionage Act here. The Espionage Act itself, under which he's being extradited to the United States, is clearly a political act, and therefore under English law he shouldn't be extradited for a political charge. And of course it's only ever been used in the US for political persecution. It was brought in 1917 to smash the anti-war movement in the United States, and it led to the imprisonment of Eugene Debs, who was a senator, who was the leader of the Socialist Party, and it also led to Bill Hayward fleeing, who was a trade union leader, fleeing to Russia. So in other words, it's an extremely undemocratic law in the first place. And of course the other thing is that Assange is not a British citizen, and he's not a US citizen. He's an Australian citizen. So how he can be arrested in Britain for being a traitor to the United States when he is in fact an Australian citizen just defies belief. And of course what it is a clear message to everybody that the US will not tolerate having its nose tweaked. And of course what WikiLeaks has exposed over the years is some of the most important and critical journalistic scoops of modern times.
Well, I mean, I was due to step up to the podium in Southport at the National Union of Journalists delegate meeting last week to put the case for the union, also backing Julian Assange, effectively saying this guy is not a terrorist, he has committed no actual crime. And that conference has been postponed as part of the coronavirus. So it's not even as if journalists are allowed to actually conduct their meeting. The union is not allowed to conduct its meeting under the present government rules.
Well, that's right. And because of the ongoing major crisis, lots of small stuff, which we in normal circumstances would be being chased up and things would be being looked into, are all being, they're basically getting away with an awful lot of stuff which they wouldn't be able to get away with in other circumstances.
Yeah, but you're defending this lockdown, Martin. Actually, it's meaning a lot of our civil liberties have been torn up.
I think that the civil liberties aspect of this is extremely worrying. I'm not suggesting for a moment that the government should be trusted in every aspect of this, of what they're trying to do. But a lockdown is, if it's going to work, has got to be based upon genuine medical reasons, and you will understand why the NUJ can't have a conference if nobody else can have a conference. Nobody's having any conferences at the moment. The NUJ aren't being singled out there, are they?
Looking at some other international stories, do feel free, Martin, if you want to bring in some more of your stuff this week. But World War III, this is in the Daily Express, how Japan could be a glove over a US fist in this fight against China. They say World War III fears have intensified as Donald Trump is ramping up his coronavirus rhetoric against China. But an unearthed documentary suggests Japan, in a strategic sense, could be the glove over Washington's fist. So, I mean, obviously, there's China and Japan have got rivalries anyway. But is, as the Express is suggesting here, Japan actually really just acting in some way as a kind of proxy for the US in that part of the world?
Well, I think that's pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, there's still, Japan is still under military occupation by the Americans. And they are there in order to threaten the Chinese. That's the reason they're there. And everybody's saying they're there to protect Japan from China. Well, that just ain't the case, is it? There's no threat from Japan to from China to Japan. The US military are basically surrounding China with bases and other mobile forces, and they're also, of course, just ripped up the intermediate forces nuclear missile treaty with the Russians, so that they can now openly surround China with cruise missiles. The Chinese see themselves as under siege by the Western powers, and of course, don't forget that the Chinese have to import a lot of raw materials through the South China Sea. It's a bit like Britain wanting to control the Channel. You know, we've controlled the Channel since we've had a Royal Navy in the 17th century, and we wouldn't let anybody get into a position where they could control the Channel, not even in World War II. And that's exactly what the Chinese are saying. You can't control our access to the sea near where our country is. It's important strategically for us to be able to bring stuff in and out without you stopping us. If we were to blockade Los Angeles, you would feel the same, wouldn't you?
You mentioned there a little earlier the whole problem with the coming war on China, the John Pilger film. In that film, Martin, it's extraordinary because it exposes an incredible thing that happened during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was a very high state of readiness for nuclear war between the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union, and NATO, the NATO countries, particularly the United States. So basically it was the US and the Soviet Union were a hair trigger for nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And during that crisis, as Pilger exposes in his film, there were the nuclear weapons in the South China Sea or the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific Ocean were given an order by the US military to fire on China. And as Pilger explains, that the commanders on the ground, one particular guy countermanded the order. He said, well, actually, we're not at war with China. We are potentially at war with Russia, but we're not going to carry out this order. But orders actually came down the line, which I find extraordinary, to actually fire live nuclear weapons at the Chinese from the Pacific.
Well, we came much closer to nuclear Armageddon there than people realised. And that's not been the only time. In 1983, at the height of the cruise missiles being put into Western Europe, we nearly came to a crisis. And underlying all of this is NATO's doctrine of not saying that it won't carry out a first strike. Basically, NATO's policy has always been to say, we're not saying that we won't carry out a first strike. The other side has got to fear a first strike from us. Both Russia and China have always said, we will never use them first, they're only defensive. But most people in the West are not aware that our policy isn't defensive. We explicitly say to the Russians and the Chinese, don't presume that we won't use them first. Now, of course, what that means is that the people on the other side have got to be absolutely on their toes, so that if there is any hint that they're about to be attacked, they immediately hit back. Now, if everybody was to say there would be no first use, then everybody could take a sigh of relief. There would be time, for example, if an incident occurred, to get on the blower and talk to the other side and say, what's going on here then? But in actual fact, we haven't got that, and that's a policy decision. So a few years ago, Jeremy Corbyn was being put under pressure. Would he press the nuclear button? Would he press the nuclear button? Of course, with the implication being that we were under attack. In actual fact, the real question is, would he carry out a first strike? Because that's NATO policy. And people listening to this should realise that is British government policy. We are committed to a first strike. That's something we could easily get rid of if we had common sense, but we haven't.
Bit of news this week. Also, the United States has been pulling its missiles and warplanes out of Saudi Arabia. This is an interesting bit of news. We've not heard much in the mainstream at all. That's on anantiwar.com. What could be going on there, do you think, Martin?
Well, it's pretty clear what's going on there. The Saudis are basically pumping oil in order to try and get market share. And on that basis, basically the US shale industry is about to go down the drain. It's not viable anyway, frankly. It never was viable. And basically it should go down the drain. But of course, Trump in an election year doesn't want to see that go down the drain. So he's losing his temper with the Saudis and he's withdrawing the Patriot missiles, which didn't protect the Saudi oil industry from the Houthi drone attack anyway. And of course, what's beginning to happen now is this global crisis develops. Is that everybody's trying to find out who their real friends are, who's on what side, where, and all the rest of it. And
well, these troops were only there, apparently, in the last couple of months to counter Iran, but now they've been withdrawn again.
Well, they're being withdrawn because the Saudis won't give up on their policy of trying to get market share through pumping oil, which basically wipes out the US shale oil industry. And, of course, Trump being the gangster he is, says you can't do that. You can't wipe out our shale oil industry. And if you do, we're going to withdraw our protection from you. We'll just let your enemies have a go at you. And, of course, basically the Saudi state is tottering. It's on the brink of collapse, in my view, although we don't hear an awful lot about it. And all sorts of political arrangements like that are basically being tested to the limit by this crisis. It's not the coronavirus is a part of the crisis, but there's also an economic component to the crisis, which is probably more fundamental. And then there's the military and geopolitical aspects, which are coming to a head. I mean, I think we are, if you know anything of history, we're barreling towards a major confrontation out of which humanity may not survive. It sounds crazy to say it, but the possibilities for mistakes here are enormous and very dangerous.
Now, another reason why that is because this week the Senate has failed to override Trump's veto of an Iran war resolution that could have curbed his ability to launch a strike. This is the Senate on Thursday, yesterday, failed to override President Donald Trump's veto of an Iran war powers resolution that would have curbed his ability to launch a military strike against Iran. In a 49-44 vote, supporters fell short of the two-thirds supermajority needed to overturn Trump's veto, which came on Wednesday evening. The resolution would have barred Trump from using military force against Iran without explicit congressional authorization. So really, Martin, this is a little nerve-wracking, isn't it? Because it's given a very, very clear green light to Trump that he can launch a war against Iran if he wants.
Well, in actual fact, under the US Constitution, the Congress are the only people who are supposed to declare war. It's been ignored for years. What was called, even back in the 1970s when I was at university, the growth of presidential power, the imperial presidency, I think it was called. But in theory, the Constitution says it's only Congress that can declare war. But of course, Congress wasn't consulted about the assassination of Soleimani any more than Boris Johnson was. Basically, Trump, if he wants to, or somebody like Pompeo, without even consulting with Trump, may decide to just start a war with Iran, and then the war will have started.
Senator Tim Kaine, the chief author of the resolution, blasted Trump for bringing electoral politics into the debate about war. He said it was not introduced, his resolution was not introduced to divide the Republican Party. It was not introduced to affect the election. It was introduced to stop a rush to an unnecessary war, Kaine told reporters in a conference call before Thursday's vote. But the president can't see that because all he can see is himself and the prospects for his own election.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, all Congress was trying to do there was assert its traditional right to make decisions about war and peace. Now, of course, it's all for over many years that's been eroded away to almost nothing. In actual fact, the US military and their allies and hangers-on are involved in military operations all over the world as we speak, in hundreds of countries. And the Congress doesn't get any say in it at all, really. But in theory, they're supposed to make those decisions. Trump is treating it as the Republicans who voted with the resolution are letting the side down from his point of view. Because as we all know, the most important thing in the world is that Donald Trump is re-elected on November the 5th. Everything else is secondary.
Also this week, we've seen the Department of Justice in the US dropping the case against Michael Flynn. Now, what was this case about, and why is it so important that Michael Flynn's case has been dropped?
Well, I'm not so sure it is that important. In the cats in a sack scenario that's going on in the US political elite, there's a huge row about what Trump did say or didn't say, whether Biden was involved in corruption in Ukraine or not.
This is going back before the Biden case, really. Collusion between Michael Flynn and the Russian state, apparently. But now they've said that wasn't happening.
Well, it was a load of rubbish in the first place. And in actual fact, I do read a lot of US stuff on the internet. And, of course, in the US, all of this stuff is gone over endlessly by all the TV anchor people and all the rest of it about whether Trump colluded and the Russians tried to fix the election and all the rest of it. It's a lot of nonsense. Flynn was a US general. He had some links to Trump. You know, he was appointed by Trump to the administration. He'd had some talks with the Russians, as you might expect for somebody at his level. And it was all turned into a whole thing about how the Russians rigged the election. Now, I'm no friend of Trump at all. But the idea that Trump was elected because the Russians got him elected is infantile. It's pathetic. But you'll find even mainstream liberal commentators in The Guardian here going on that we all know that Putin got Trump elected and that Putin's responsible. I mean, I was a Remain voter, but the idea that Leave campaign run because Putin was running it is just nuts. It's bonkers, but that's what the mainstream is full of these days. Essentially, diversionary drivel.
The other thing is, of course, Michael Flynn was doing some measures. Some called it treachery at the time, but to actually have a kind of rapprochement with the Russians, to actually make Russia America's friend and ally.
Well, one of the things he did, for example, was go to a dinner in Moscow for the anniversary of the creation of RT, which Russia Today, which I sometimes go on, because Putin was at the same dinner. And on that basis, he's been regarded as some kind of Russian stooge, blah, 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 blah. Now, in actual fact, in the modern world, we live in a globalized society. People go and do all sorts of different things. And there's, you know, ongoing contacts and discussions between people on the same level at opposite sides of Russia and the US should just be regarded as normal stuff. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to agree. There's quite clearly big differences in policy and what people want to see happen in Russia and in the US. But the idea that people shouldn't talk to each other at all is, again, just ridiculous. Of course people talk [S2] Right. [S1] To each other, and there's no reason why they shouldn't.
Just come in with any other stories if you want, Martin. But one of them I thought you may have picked up on this week is an incredible hour and a half documentary broadcast by BBC Scotland on Tuesday this week called Eminent Monsters. I mean, obviously referring to the fact that some very, very important people were involved in some of the most horrendous Nazi-style experiments on human beings. And we'll be hearing more about some of the people who seem to want to do all sorts of deals with the Nazis at the end of the war for VE Day a bit later. But this documentary by BBC Scotland examines a guy called Ewan Cameron, who was the scientist in charge of essentially a US, obviously with British cooperation as well, program called MK Ultra. Now, many people, you know, talk about fake news, etc., But this really was a program about mind control, the idea being that you can use certain techniques, and they were building on work done by the Nazis here, in order to control vast populations of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people's opinions through the mass media.
Yeah, well, it's not just the mass media. I mean, basically, they took the view... What propaganda in World War One was relatively crude and pretty blatant on all sides. In World War Two, propaganda became more sophisticated, certainly on the Allied side. And now, of course, we've now moved on where psychological warfare operations are ongoing. Brigade 77, which we learn about through the media here, has been set up in recent years in this country. It's a section of the British Army. It has 1,000 employees, and they spend all day, every day, online, pretending to be people they're not, in order to steer political judgments and public opinion in directions suitable for the overall plan that the British armies have for example, overthrowing Assad. So we're paying for that. And what that means, effectively, is that British officers are coming onto social media platforms and sowing disinformation about what's going on, and being paid from by our taxes to do it.
And well, one of the most interesting aspects,
democracy.
One of the most interesting, well, we're talking about undermining democracy, absolutely. One of the most interesting aspects of MK Ultra was the way it was used in order to basically spy on and use techniques for entrapment of people using sexual peccadilloes of various sorts, including prostitutes and that sort of thing. But the idea being that all the leading members of society, the opinion formers in society, could potentially be compromised. And this is something that has also been evidenced by what we've seen with the VI paedophile scandals and things like the Dutroux scandal. It does look as if there's been a program building on the research of MK Ultra and the research the Nazis did in order to get many, many people at the top echelons of society in total either compromised or compromisable.
Yeah, I mean, there are various aspects to this. It's a totalitarian project. So you've got the blackmailing of people in positions of authority. You've got the general bamboozlement of the population. There's MK Ultra is a massive program, and of course it was eventually exposed through Freedom of Information Acts. And then they said, "Oh well, we did some terrible things. Like we fed loads of people LSD, for example, without consent. All sorts of stuff like this." And of course, the standard things like assassination, character assassination, and so on. All of this has become normalised as psychological warfare, and the British Army, for example, even boasts about its capabilities in this area. And of course, what they're really doing is moulding the minds of the population, their own population, to perceive the rest of the world in a certain kind of a way. And then, of course, they say, well, public opinion demands that we intervene in Syria because we've planted all these stories about chemical weapons in the media. Everybody thinks that the Syrians have carried out chemical weapons attacks. And then you can carry through a kind of, on the back of that, you can then carry out, as we have done, missile strikes into Syria. Of course, the Syrians basically did not respond, but they could have done. And they would have been within their rights in international law to do so, because they didn't carry out chemical weapons attacks. Those have been carried out by NATO-linked forces.
These acts, Martin, start looking like just simple provocations, actually. The idea is they want a response.
That's right. And, of course, the Syrians didn't respond. But I put it to you this, they could have responded, and the obvious way for them to respond was to whack a few missiles into the RAF base at Akrotiri and kill a few people. And then, of course, you really would have a casus belli. That's why they didn't do it. But on the other hand, they are risking people's lives with these provocations. At some point,
that's right. People will
hit back, and you will pay the price.
Well, I mean, if they were to do what we supposedly did to them, you might see a chemical attack in London, for example.
Well, indeed, but they're not going to do that because they ain't stupid. If there's a chemical attack in London blamed on the Syrians, you can be damn sure it wasn't them. It's probably our own people pretending to be the Syrians. And that's the real world we live in now. We cannot trust the deep state to protect the ordinary people. It's not there.
This building, Ewan Cameron, certainly fascinating, the Scottish doctor behind the massive mind control operation, which built on the work of the Nazi scientists, human experimenters like Dr. Mengele, on BBC Scotland this week. Let's have a clip from that now.
I remember a nurse bringing my father down, and he'd gone from a man to this almost non-human creature. Here he starts to try to get rid of the equipment that they used to put him in sensory isolation. He's mumbling incoherently. He's trying to remove his goggles. He's trying to remove his cuffs. Over and over again, that he's incoherent.
We trust doctors. We put our lives in their hands. But some betray that trust. For the last 60 years, doctors working for the British and American governments have used psychological torture to destroy people.
They start off each interrogation saying, can I have your name? I'm mentally trying to spell my own name. I don't know what the mistake is, but I know the way I'm spelling it is wrong.
To tell this story, we need to go back to the 1950s, when Scottish psychiatrist Dr. Ewan Cameron experimented on his own patients.
The MI5 agent, he simply identified himself as Andy. When they lifted the hood over my head, I see Andrew standing in front of me in the middle of the desert in Afghanistan. Andrew would simply say repeatedly, there's nothing I or we, the British government, can do about your situation. You have to cooperate with the Americans.
They said, what do you think about waterboarding? I said, I like it a lot. I don't think it's tough enough.
In the past, we have foolishly released hundreds and hundreds of dangerous terrorists, only to meet them again on the battlefield. I just signed an order to keep open the detention facilities in Guantanamo Bay.
A few moments ago, Dr. Ewan Cameron of Montreal, chairman of the organizing committee, opened this Third World Congress of Psychiatry with these words.
These are the days and hours are the occasions that summon up determination, fire of the imagination, and drive us forward in this greatest of endeavors.
I'm about to go see the Allen Memorial Institute, where my father spent on and off 4 tragic years. I remember my dad before, and I remember my dad after. It was 1 year after my bar mitzvah, so I was 14, and I remember the Christmas holidays that year with my father pacing the house, going back and forth, singing this sort of crazy song from the, I think it's the 30s, called Mary's Eat Oats and Doe's Eat Oats and Little Lambs Eat Ivy, over and over and over again, and my being very puzzled and not understanding what was happening, which is how he ended up in 1956 going to see Ewan Cameron at the Allen Memorial Institute.
So that's a clip there from Eminent Monsters. This is a BBC Scotland programme. A lot of people very critical of the BBC, but it seems that there is still just about the spirit of real investigative journalism is alive. I mean, it's interesting to note that back in 1986, it was BBC Scotland that were raided by Special Branch for putting out a series called Secret Society, which was exposing the operation of secret cabinet committees, the Zircon satellite, which had been smuggled past the House of Commons without them being able to scrutinise it, even though it was a multi-million pound project, cover stories were given, and it was hidden in the accounts so that MPs weren't able to scrutinise it. And that series by Duncan Campbell is still available online. You can still see some of the footage shot by the BBC Scotland camera people as the special branch raided Scotland in the 1980s. And it's good to see that some parts of the UK are still doing some really good investigative journalists, the BBC particular. And that film, again, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which you can still watch on the iPlayer, the film Eminent Monsters by BBC Scotland. Martin, let's go on to a different kind of warfare now. We just heard about psychological warfare. We've heard about real warfare before that, but now it's economic warfare. And this week, Germany has issued a declaration of war, at least some German politicians have put it that way, against the European Central Bank's 1.9 trillion bailout. Now, the German government have long been actually very critical of the quantitative easing program, this idea of creating money out of nowhere by the European Central Bank. And now the German Constitutional Court has challenged the European Central Bank to prove its massive purchasing of government debt is proportionate to face the Bundesbank actually being blocked from participating in the program. So this is the Bundesbank, which is the German Central Bank, actually coming up against the European Central Bank.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously what's happening in the US with the Federal Reserve, because it's a very slapdash setup over there, they have just piled into the market to prop it all up, and not just US companies. The whole global system is being propped up by the Federal Reserve. And, of course, there's nothing in the Federal Reserve's constitution that allows it to do this, but they've done it anyway because there's no checks and balances. In Germany, where you've got a more legalistic culture, they've basically been chipping away. I mean, being very resistant to the idea of creating any kind of bailout. It's bizarre, really, because ultimately, if they don't bail out the southern European countries will default, and that will crash the German economy. So it's a very much cutting off your nose to spite your face situation. But they probably will not allow the ECB to create facilities to help Spain and Italy in particular, and then they will go down the drain. But as Spain and Italy go down the drain, Germany will go down the drain, and Britain, of course, in or out of the EU, will go down the drain as well, because in actual fact, everything's connected to everything else. Well, and you can't just walk away.
Hang on, because the court said the decision published today does not concern any financial assistance measures taken by the European Union or the European Central Bank in the context of the current coronavirus crisis. Ahead of the judgment, there were fears a ruling against the European Central Bank could have triggered a serious Eurozone crisis. The European Central Bank has bought more than £1.9 trillion, that's €2.2 trillion, of public sector debt since launching its quantitative easing program back in 2014. So they're not specifically looking at this coronavirus as and saying, we don't like that. What they're saying is, effectively, what you were saying earlier, is you're using, the European Central Bank is using the coronavirus crisis to print money to actually undermine the entire basis of European economies.
No, well, I mean, you're mixing various things up there. What, as I understand it, what the Constitutional Court in Germany has done, which is significant, is they've said that what's happened so far, where the ECB has been buying up some bonds and so on, pretty much like the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England, that is unconstitutional under German law. Now, if that is carried through, that means that the ECB can't do what it's already been doing, never mind do anything else as a result of the coronavirus crisis. Now, if this carries through, there will be a massive collapse in the European economy. There's going to be one anyway, even if they did agree to print money, just as the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England do. It's not going to be enough. In this situation, the possibility, we're talking about a second wave of the virus, but over the summer, the banking system may collapse. It's been on the verge of collapse since 2008, and we've now reached the point where, especially if things like this start occurring, the whole thing is going to go down like a house of cards, and then we really will be in a very serious situation.
Well, we are in a serious situation with the virus around the world, and on Newsnight this week, I was absolutely quite shocked to see a NHS doctor come on demanding that the former Foreign Secretary and Labour MP David Miliband, and not to be confused with his brother Ed Miliband, who was Leader of the Opposition, David Miliband, should lead the world against coronavirus. So let's have a listen to David Notnow, the doctor, speaking on to Kirsty Walk, I think it was, on the BBC's Newsnight programme this week.
You're very, very concerned about the impact still yet to hit on both refugee camps and areas of other settlements, particularly in developing world.
Very much so. I mean, we had a massive amount of infrastructure. We had equipment, we had ventilators, we had nursing staff, we had doctors. And when you think about the results that we had, this disease is so virulent, it's so dangerous and so pathogenic, it causes such high mortality that results recently that have been published from the Intensive Care Society have shown that 65% of patients that in the best hands possible died. And if you had another kidney problem or something on top of that, then you had an 80% chance of dying on a ventilator.
The scenario you are suggesting is that by the very fact that we are so inward looking, we have actually got another crisis on the global doorstep.
Absolutely. If you look at David Miliband and you look at his International Rescue Committee, he did some modelling based on the Imperial College and WHO. And in 34 fragile countries, he's shown that in the next few weeks, if we don't do anything, 500 million or 1 billion people will become infected. And of that, 3 million will possibly die. And that is in the low-income countries, hostile environments, and so on. And so the big problem is that it's nothing to do with ventilatory support in these countries. We really, really have to ramp up public health support in all these countries. Otherwise, it'll be too late.
Yeah, but you saw the failure of international cooperation in Syria. What you seem to be suggesting is that you have doubts about international cooperation here on this front, unless it's led by somebody specific. Not a country, not a group, not a committee.
This is a global problem, and we're really all in different, our little countries, dealing with the problems on our own and making big mistakes in not our countries, but other countries are making huge mistakes. And when you look at the Ebola crisis and you look at, you know, what happened in the monetary system in 2008, it was led by a global leader, really, and that was America. But now I don't think we've got that global leadership anymore. And what we really, really need is a global pandemic executive, perhaps, which can go to every country of this world and say, look, we have learned from this pandemic. We have learned how to deal with it. We know what the problems are.
Led by whom?
Led by David Miliband, without a shadow of a doubt. You've got somebody who's a respectful statesman, politician, and has an enormous track record, and he needs to be in charge of it. We really need to get our act together within the next few weeks. What we have is this time now, which is like February, for us, what we had this year. We have now got their February this time, so we've got 4 weeks to do as much preventative treatment, much preventative care as we possibly can, ramp up public health services, get people in, for example, water consultants, engineers, to make sure that all these countries have proper hand washing, have facilities for social distancing, because that is the only way that this virus is going to be contained.
So that's Dr. David Knott speaking on Newsnight this week to Kirsty Walk. Apparently we need a global pandemic executive, Martin, and David Miliband is the man to lead it.
Well, I mean, the political unreality of that is extraordinary. There's no particular reason why we're going to appoint anybody to be a super national authority to deal with the crisis. And why David Miliband? I mean, the International Rescue Committee, I used to run across their people, I used to work with their people in Bosnia, and we used to joke about them calling them Thunderbirds. But there's no particular reason why he or anybody else should be appointed to such a body. Why? And of course, there is a problem in the developing world, and something needs to be done. But it's quite likely it won't be done because, as pointed out, we've only got a few weeks to do it and it ain't going to happen.
Let's also remind everybody about the Roland Dumas statement, which he made about the meeting he was sent over to in London in 2009 when David Miliband was Foreign Secretary, which was about the, supposedly anyway, recruiting various supporters for starting a civil war in Syria. And that was done under David Miliband's watch. The other thing Miliband did is he was actually encouraging torture. And the it was only after the Tory government came in 2010 that it was revealed that Miliband himself had been involved in basically giving a nod and a wink for torture going on. And people like Bijam Ibrahimi, who potentially anyway should have been in the courts, and MI6 and MI5 could have been prosecuted for his torture. It was then Keir Starmer as Director of Public Prosecutions that meant that there were no prosecutions. So surely David Miliband is the last person anyone should think of. Is he's been involved in sanctioning torture from the top, and also, of course, involved in potentially anyway in starting the Syrian civil war.
This is interesting that Kirsty Walk there said we didn't have any international cooperation over Syria. What she means by that is we didn't go to war with Assad. And that's, of course, what was being pushed at the time. And, of course, Miliband, David Miliband, was very much embedded in the Atlanticist pro-NATO wing of the Labour Party, which is one of the reasons why his brother beat him to be Labour leader, because we didn't trust Miliband. Miliband had gone along with the Iraq war, and in many respects, as far as we were concerned, he was damaged goods, and we weren't having him.
No, so I know you have done some door knocking with David Miliband as part of the Labour Party here in Bristol too.
Yes, that's right.
How come he decided to sort of give up on the Labour Party and go and?
When he didn't win the leadership, he went off in a huff, basically. And his brother took it over. I mean, I suppose in a way you could argue he wanted to give his brother a clear go, so he got out of the way. And of course, he then went off to New York to head up the IRC on a salary of about $500,000 a year. He's become one of the great and the good. And it's not surprising that he's based in the US, because his politics have always been very close to those of the US establishment.
Give us an idea of what this International Rescue Committee is. You say it's called Thunderbirds. Yes,
we used to call them Thunderbirds. They were set up in World War II to rescue Jewish families from Nazi persecution, but they've subsequently become a major NGO operating in crisis situations all around the world. But of course they were, David Miliband at one stage was pushing for military intervention in Syria, get this, so that they could carry out a vaccination program. Cause he said that, we'll have to get into Syria so that we can vaccinate the kids. I mean, talk about, you know, missing the point entirely. And of course, underlying all of this is that the war in Syria was created by the NATO intelligence services. They armed and trained the jihadi terrorists, which tried to overthrow the government of Assad. Assad won a democratic election in 2014. It's completely ignored in the West. Many people were not happy with the regime previously, but when they saw who was trying to overthrow the regime, they rallied round the Assad family, basically, because they're a family business.
Martin, another aspect of the sort of coronavirus pandemic, let's just bring it back to home for a second and maybe look at the international implications of this too, is that the government is apparently, according to The Guardian, using the pandemic to transfer the NHS over to the private sector, offering a load of new contracts to private companies, the stuff that used to be done by the Nationalised Health Service.
Yeah, well, they've been running the NHS down for years. So when a crisis like this happens, they say, oh, we haven't got capacity, we'll have to bring in the private sector. And, of course, they're not letting a good crisis go to waste. There's a possibility, as we were discussing in the first hour, that the government could actually step up to the plate here and basically take over running the economy. That's effectively what we're saying. You know, if we're going to have lockdowns like this, the government's got to run it all. A bit like World War II. Yeah, we're going to have a planned economy. But, of course, they don't want that. What they're going to use it for is a mechanism to try and bring through all the things they were going to bring through anyway, and more privatisation, et cetera, et cetera. And I've no confidence whatsoever that the current Tory government will do the right thing here. They've been forced, to some extent, to do the right thing. But, of course, they haven't even done the right thing right, in the right way. They're bailing out companies instead of bailing out the people. If you bail the people out, they can then float the companies that they think are viable. If you bail the companies out, you've got a middleman there that might not, you might not want. Loads of businesses are not going to survive this crisis. There is no point bailing out businesses that aren't going to be there when the crisis is over. And of course, the crisis isn't going to be over. It's just started. It's going to end in a major economic collapse. And then there is going to be social change of some kind. So a very major social change. It could be positive or it could be horribly negative.
Martin, that social change could come about through starvation and eviction.
Well, it's going to come out, yes, and war. I mean, the war zones around the world are still ramping up. We were talking earlier about the attempt to overthrow the government of Venezuela. At any moment now, it could break out in the Gulf. The possibilities here are all pretty horrendous. But inevitably, there was always going to be a third. It's quite clear that what's going on now is equivalent to World War One and World War Two. This is World War Three, and it's very different. Each war is uniquely horrible in its own way. This one is going to be uniquely horrible. Probably people listening now will not see the end of it. Hopefully out of it may come something better because of the reaction to everything being so badly mismanaged. But the real danger, of course, is it's all just going to go down the drain. In poorer countries, definitely. In richer countries, likely. It's not going to be fun. It's going to be...
Martin, you're painting a very negative picture about this. But actually, for a lot of people, the lockdowns, the pandemic hasn't been too bad. They've been able to actually spend a bit of time getting to know their family and out enjoying the sun.
Well, I mean, personally, I have not suffered too much as a result of all of this yet. But the fact is that people have, it's allowed us to take a step back, those who aren't directly on the front line, and think about what really matters in life. And that could lead to changes of values which could be productive and useful to us. Going forward, we need to build a better society that looks after everybody. And it's pretty obvious, isn't it? If you've got stuff like this out there, no man is an island. If small countries or poor countries go down the drain and become totally hopelessly infected with coronavirus, that is going to come back to bite you in the bum wherever you live.
For homeless people in Bristol, you know, suddenly they're put up in hotels. I mean, so there's a little bit of a silver lining too, surely.
There was a silver lining to World War Two, if you remember. Yeah, and out of it came the National Health Service as a concept. So here we are on VE Day, and everybody, in theory, including the Tory government, thinks the NHS is a wonderful organisation. They just haven't bothered to spend any money on it for years. And basically, if you look at the stuff that the people in the cabinet have written in Britannia Unchained, which came out some years ago, they basically, their aspiration is to break it up and destroy it. They're on the record of saying that. Now they're coming out in front of everybody saying, isn't it wonderful? And the other thing, of course, is all the people working in care homes, doing absolutely essential work, looking after the ill, the old, the frail. And they are basically being thrown to the wolves. And we ought to, out of this, develop a completely different attitude to people doing that kind of work. They need to massively increase what they're paid. They need to have jobs for life. They need to have trade union representation. They need to work directly for the government, not for rip-off private enterprise. And that is the sort of thing that we did in Britain at the end of the 1940s. Why can't we do it again?
Well, the RE or VE Day behind the BBC hype we look at today. And first, the atom bomb. Evidence emerging over the last two or three years through official documents and the discovery of radioactive material in Germany, the Nazis tested an atomic bomb in October 1944. That's 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July 1945. Martin, I mean, this is an incredible revelation. It's not been sort of one news story, but it's been trickling out over the last 3 years or so, which is amazing, isn't it, since it's 75 years after the event, the end of the war. That information is coming to light, that actually the Nazis were way, way ahead of the Americans on the atom bomb. And this also throws into, effective relief, the attitude of Winston Churchill in 1944 and 1945. If you read all the various literature on the subject, and there's quite a bit around, not least of which is the scientific literature, which suggests that I think it was the, I'm just trying to remember the guy's name. He wrote a book called Most Secret War. I can't remember his name, actually, but he was saying that Churchill was absolutely paranoid at the end of the war that there was going to be some kind of, R.V. Jones, that's right, Most Secret War, that there was going to be a V2 with an atom bomb on it was going to hit London in late 44, early 45 sometime. And the evidence is now that that absolutely was a correct threat. Churchill knew what he was saying because in October there'd been a nuclear test. And actually Churchill would have known that because it's come out in documents, you know, 70 years or so after the war, that the intelligence services had got reports of it.
Well, I mean, obviously, for some people listening, they're going to say, wow, this is all very, this is very convoluted. I think we'll need to put links up on the show for people to investigate this for themselves. But the idea that some kind of deal was done with elements within the Nazi regime at the end of the war, I think that's pretty clear. The head of the BND, the West German Secret Services, after the war, was Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo.
Well, look, let's just can we stick with the nuclear question, please? Recently declassified file APO-696 from the National Archives in Washington is a detailed survey of how far Third Reich scientists got in the development of an atom bomb, something Hitler craved. In the file obtained by the daily newspaper Bild, the task of the academics who prepared the paper between 1944 and 1947 was investigations, research, developments and practical use of the German atomic bomb. The report was prepared by countless American and British intelligence officers and also includes the testimony of four German experts, two chemical physicists, a chemist and a missile expert. It concurs that Hitler's scientists failed in the quest to achieve a breakthrough in nuclear technology, but that there was a documented test of a warhead in 1944. The statement of the German test pilot Hans Zintzer in the file is considered hard evidence. The missile expert says he observed in 1944 a mushroom cloud in the sky during a test flight near Ludwigslust. His log submitted to the Allied investigators reads, "In early October 1944, I flew away 12 to 15 kilometres from a nuclear test station near Ludwigslust, south of Lübeck." And in fact, in this article, I'll put a link up on our show page, they've got the actual intelligence report from the war. It said a cloud shaped like a mushroom with turbulent billowing sections at about 7,000 metres stood without any seeming connections over the spot where the explosion took place. Now, is this credible, I'll ask you, that the Germans were so far ahead, you know, 9 months ahead of the Americans, actually, in testing atomic weapons?
Well, I understand that the implication of all of this is that a deal was done with elements within the regime, and they then got access to Germany's nuclear program, which allowed them to expedite their program to nuke Japan. And, of course, deals were done, as we know. But Bormann was probably, or we know, was taken out of Berlin at the end of in 1945 by the British and then ends up in...
Okay, well, look, there's another report as well, also from 2017 in the newspapers. This one, I think, is in the Independent, in the British Independent. An amateur treasure hunter in Germany has stumbled what he believes is radioactive material from a secret research facility dating back to World War II. 64-year-old Bernard Thernmann, he was exploring ground in Orianburg, northeast Germany, with his metal detector when it gave an unusual bleep. After bringing the mysterious object home, the pensioner alerted the authorities about his discovery of a shiny lump of metal. Police discovered the find was radioactive, leading to the evacuation of all the residents from several houses and calling emergency services. Specialists in hazmat suits searched his home and removed the suspicious object in a lead-lined container, which was then placed inside a protective suitcase. Mr. Thalman, rather than being congratulated for finding this, is now being investigated for being in possession of unauthorized radioactive substances. German authorities revealed the area was the location of Adolf Hitler's secret uranium enrichment facility. The research center was tasked with enriching uranium oxide imported from South America to make weapons-grade plutonium. So, Martin, this is another bit of evidence here. This has only come out in the last couple of years. This is from actually 3 years ago, that there was definitely enriched uranium in Nazi Germany. So, you know, this report of an atomic bomb being tested could be real. The other thing is, you've got all of the names of all of these, you know, Niels Bohr and the rest. I think he was Swedish, but many of the Eastern Europeans were the first actual atomic scientists to split the atom. Frisch and Piles in Birmingham's Nuffield University, who supposedly designed the first atomic bomb as an actual theoretical design in 1940. One of them was German, the other one Austrian. So it's hardly surprising the Germans should have been ahead on this nuclear bomb technology, potentially a war-winning technology.
Well, Niels Bohr was Danish, but yes. Well, don't forget, one of the things that's caused problems for them is that a lot of Jewish scientists fled from Nazi Germany and ended up in the United States, taking with them a lot of the secrets that they had. And just as their racist attitude towards Ukrainians and Poles led to their loss on the Eastern Front. There's still plenty more to discover about what happened at the end of the war, because ultimately I think it's pretty clear that deals were done, dirty deals were done. And that, of course, explains an awful lot about the fascist psychological warfare technique that NATO has always embodied, going back to the 1940s when the Gladio networks were originally set up using the Wolf networks that had been set up by the Germans. So what the implication of this is that the Bormann faction in the Nazi party did a deal with the West, and they were basically led off and escaped, and they gave the nuclear weapons to the West, which then allowed, of course, the nuking of Japan, and of course then led to a situation where the Soviet Union could be contained by the Western nuclear power. And of course they definitely discussed the possibility of nuking the Soviet Union before they were able to develop any nuclear weapons.
Well, I think it'd just be interesting now to have a listen to a Horizon called Hitler's Bomb, which was produced in 1993 by the BBC. And they were, in a way, they were putting together much of this evidence, even though none of the admissions about enriched uranium that the Nazis held. I mean, we just heard in that last story I read out about Bernard Thälmann finding this bit of uranium and then getting into all sorts of trouble because he wouldn't tell the authorities there where exactly he'd found it. German authorities revealed the area of Oranienburg was the location of Adolf Hitler's secret uranium enrichment facility. Well, the question then arises, of course, what happened to that enriched uranium after the war, even though it's now been officially admitted by the German authorities that it did exist and they were producing enriched uranium. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a little section from this Horizon film from 1993. Even though the conclusion of the documentary is that the Nazis hadn't developed any kind of real nuclear capability, you can see from this excerpt that there was definitely discussions between various nuclear scientists outside Germany and inside Germany that it was definitely possible. And these discussions took place right at the beginning of the war.
In fact, what I really wanted to discuss with you this evening was a question that's been troubling me somewhat.
Really?
Concerning the military application of our work.
Military application?
I value your opinion on the moral issue, Niels. The question being, of course, whether it's right for us as scientists to be working on the uranium problem in times of war, when it's very possible that our work could lead to the most grave consequences in the technique of warfare.
You genuinely believe our work has military application, eh?
Of course. In theory, that is.
Wait, what? What are you saying exactly? What are you talking about? A bomb? An atomic bomb?
We've made some progress in that direction. It would take the most terrific technical effort, of course, but yes, it's a possibility.
A quarter of an hour after the end of the war, Heisenberg saw me and said, I'm afraid it was a complete failure. And then I said, why? And he said, well, I started carefully, cautiously, And when Bohr realized that I was speaking about the possibility of making nuclear weapons, Bohr became so excited that he was not able to listen anymore.
You see why I had to speak to you. Frankly, I'm at a loss.
Yes, I see.
The Americans are bound to be working on the same problem, so what choice do we have? The result could be absolutely catastrophic. The release of energy would be so immense, it'd be decisive.
But once I approached Schumann, who was in charge of the whole thing in the military office, and said, would it not be good to tell some higher people in the government about this matter? And Schumann said, please don't do it. Because if Hitler, he said, der Führer, hears that nuclear weapons are possible, he will say half a year and then they must be there. And you know that this is not feasible, and for you and for me it would be a very bad position. Please keep away from such ideas.
Well, the Nazi scientist in charge of their bomb program was Werner Heisenberg, and there's a portrayal there in that BBC documentary, Hitler's Bomb from Horizon from 1993, of him meeting up with Niels Bohr right near the start of the war and discussing these topics. But, Martin, what apparently happened in Nazi Germany is the whole operation was considered so sensitive that it was moved out of the military program, away from the influence of people like Albert Speer, who was the armaments minister, and they decided to call it a civil program. And yet it developed as completely out of the sphere of what many people would consider to be the military. But nevertheless, it was developed. And I would just contrast this really with the way that much military research in the West has been moved into the civil area too. I did a visit to Joint European Torus at Cullum Laboratory, gosh, must be 20 years ago now, maybe even 25 years ago, and the physicists there explained to me, well, this is actually a military program under the guise of civil experimentation, because what they're doing is they're looking at the characteristics of various different substances in a nuclear explosion, and they're using the donut, they called it, the fission project, simply as a way to experiment on what would way various materials behave in a nuclear bomb. And so that was all covered as a civil in the civil budget. So it seems that that idea of using a civilian cover for a military weapons program is still going on today, possibly.
Well, indeed. And also, of course, in relation to this, the biological warfare labs, which are run by the Pentagon, which are all scattered around in the countries in between Russia and China, like Georgia, Kazakhstan, and other places. It's not that they claim that they are there to investigate viruses and bacteria that could cause damage, but they're all funded by the military programs. So they're basically military facilities. And of course, the Chinese and the Russians aren't happy about them being there, and they're raising questions about what is going on in these places.
Well, going back to the October 1944 German nuclear test, which there is plenty of evidence for, I'll put a link to the articles which came out in 2017 about that with the wartime intelligence documentation up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, alongside the evidence of people in Germany near Orianburg discovering actual bits and pieces of fissile material lying around. And then the government actually admitting that this was where uranium was enriched during the Nazi years. An hour later, from the previous eyewitness to that atom bomb test, a pilot in a different machine took off from Ludwigslust and observed the same phenomenon. According to other archive documents, the Italian correspondent Luigi Romersa observed on the ground the same explosion. He had been sent by dictator Benito Mussolini to watch the test of a new weapon by the Germans. He was ordered to report his impressions back to Mussolini. So, tremendous amount of evidence. But Martin, the next big question here, you alluded to this earlier, is what happened to this enriched uranium? Apparently, they had 500 kilos of the stuff, nearly half a ton, encased in gold, and they were ready at the end of the war to send it off to Japan in a submarine.
Yeah, but as you know, what may have happened is that that submarine was diverted by Martin Bormann to the United States, and the enriched uranium basically ended up in bombs which were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because there was a change going on behind the scenes. Elements within the Nazi regime were realigning with the Western powers against Japan in first place, and of course, ultimately, in order to contain the Soviet Union.
Well, we're speaking on the 75th anniversary of VE Day. That is to say, in 2020, the 8th of May 2020. Another aspect to all of this, Martin, is the loot. The looted wealth of Europe, which the Nazis had control of. And I think that's also a trail worth following, picked up very, very well by the CBS, former CBS wartime correspondent and journalist on the radio, broadcasting to America from Europe during World War II, who wrote a book after the war in the 1980s, actually, it was published, called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, where he describes this laundered money from Nazi Germany, from Bormann, who'd been brought out as Op JB, the book by Christopher Crichton describes, by the British, and with the collusion of Winston Churchill, with the promise to those soldiers involved, in the commandos involved in bringing Bormann out by rivers and canals from Berlin into the British sector, delivering him up to Desmond Morton, the former aide-de-camp to General Haig in World War I, the author of the Zinoviev letter in between the wars, and that money coming through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, being laundered into these 750 companies created by Bormann, but remotely from South America, and the Nazi SS people basically just putting on suits and walking into directorships for those firms, transnational companies designed to have an immense amount of wealth and power, but secretly working for a kind of Fourth Reich mafia after the war.
Well, that's right. And I think that anybody who looks into this, even cursorily, will see that elements within the Nazi state were definitely reappointed after the war, and nothing happened to them. A certain number of people were scapegoated. They were executed. There was a whole process of so-called denazification, but it was very half-hearted. And ultimately, basically, the fascist intelligence networks and other networks that were basically helped at that time became the basis, first of the OAS and then of the CIA and MI6. So the fascist intelligence structure was absorbed into NATO's intelligence structure, which is pretty clear from what I mentioned earlier about Reinhard Gehlen. He used to head up the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, and he said, "Do you want all my agents inside Russia?" And of course they said, "Yes, we do." And of course the other thing they did is they got the Kempeitai, the Japanese intelligence service, were all let off because they handed over all of their files on stuff they've been doing on biological warfare by basically carrying out, you know, unethical experiments on their prisoners. And the British and the Americans got access to all of the results of those experiments on the understanding that the Japanese concerned would not be punished. And of course they weren't punished. And both modern Germany and modern Japan are stuffed with people who were complicit in war crimes in the 1940s.
Yeah, and this is also the SS general, Paul Hauser. He was the commander of the Das Reich Division, an SS unit of the German army. He was using that unit right throughout the war. And at the end of the war, he said that NATO was formed from the international supporters of the SS during the war. I mean, is that feasible?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the right wing in the West and the right wing in Germany buried the hatchet, as Hitler was left out of the loop, of course, because otherwise he would have sabotaged it all. And then they went to war with the Soviet Union immediately afterwards. And they certainly discussed the possibility of nuking the Soviet Union immediately at the end of the war, because they could have done. But ultimately, of course, the communist or the Soviet intelligence operation was pretty good as well, and they'd infiltrated everything that was going on in the West, so they knew what was going on. And the Rosenbergs and Klaus Fuchs and others, who were scientists within the nuclear program in the West, basically leaked how to make an H-bomb for example, to the Soviets. And that, of course, then leveled the playing field. You can't actually nuke them anymore because they're going to nuke you back. But that was only because the Soviets had sufficient intelligence assets to thwart it.
Well, what about this OpJB I was talking about earlier, this book by Christopher Crichton, a.k.a. John Ainsworth Davis, actually. He's Christopher Crichton, that's his real name. The idea that you can have Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, doing considerable amount of secret deals for possibly many years during the war with Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann. Is that possible?
It's not just possible, it's probably what happened. And of course, don't forget that the Nazis coming to power in the first place was with quite a lot of nudges and helps from Western intelligence services, like and oligarchs like Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W. Bush, who was arrested at one stage by Roosevelt for cooperating with the enemy during the 40s. The wealthy classes in the West were behind Hitler before he came to power.
Well, trying to bring this round to today. We're looking now at a situation with the United States attempting regime change, attacking Venezuela without any proper approval by Congress, by being very much the aggressor in world affairs, and looking actually much, much more like a kind of Nazi Germany in terms of the way that they are breaking international law. I mean, Hitler, he was... doing this stuff back in the 1930s and 40s, the US presidents, US deep state seems to be doing something rather too similar today. And Churchill, back in the war, when he was talking about, we will be the people to stand against Christian civilization. Nowadays, it almost seems as if the whole thing has turned on its head, that you've got, countries like China and Iran are basically the only ones saving the world from going down the road of might is right.
Well, that's right. I mean, the US basically, for example, they're not members of the International Criminal Court. They're quite happy when the International Criminal Court takes their political opponents and puts them on trial, but they're not prepared to submit to it themselves. And the International Criminal Court suggested that they might investigate war crimes in Afghanistan, and they're even trying to persecute the individual members of the court and make sure, ruin them in every way they possibly can. Basically, we've got a lawless regime in the United States of America. And don't forget, they're far more powerful than Germany was in the 1940s. And the damage they can do is that much greater. And if you think of all the covert and overt wars that they have fought in places like Mozambique and Angola and Cambodia, the list is long. We're talking about millions and millions of dead as a result of US imperialism. And that is very dangerous.
The other thing is, the other aspect to all of this, of course, is the light thrown on the Nazi assassination programs, the imprisonment programs, the internment, the Holocaust. By Edwin Black's book, IBM and the Holocaust, because the actual records, the computer records today, are pretty much the equivalent of the punch card records which were kept by these IBM Hollerith machines in Nazi Germany. The surveillance state was very important. Back in the Nazi Germany, the Gestapo would basically press a few buttons on one of these IBM machines for any town that they could have a list of addresses, names, for the Gestapo to go around and arrest Jews, for example. A very similar sort of system is around today, what with massive profiling of the population, a massive data mining by these companies like Palantir, who boast that they can get everyone's data, and then, of course, they sell it on to anyone that wants to use it for profit. Even companies like Google and Facebook collaborating with these data miners, many would say. But Martin, this is another aspect to all of this. The surveillance that is around today actually is far, far greater than the Nazis had during World War II.
Well, it is. I mean, basically, you've got to regard all of this as a development that's been ongoing for a century. And we're now reaching the turning point. We are either going to get a grip over these powerful oligarchies, which use all of these underhand techniques to control the population, or we're not. And, the decisive question is going to be asked very shortly. As the Chinese say, when the two rice bowls clash, we'll see which one is fuller.
And we'll finish tonight with a look at the interview I did earlier this week. I don't often have interviews with me on here, but this is on the Richie Allen Show, where I and Richie have been discussing for a long time this whole... In fact, I spoke to him first probably 12 years ago, just about the same time as we started on FM, our BCFM radio show, Martin. I was chatting to him when he was a presenter for several years, many years, actually, on Talk Radio Europe, which is an English language station in Marbella in Spain. And we used to do regular sessions on there, talking about Princess Diana and all sorts of other things. And the thing I did with him this week was all really about the whole Martin Bormann story, right from start to finish, really. And I suppose the other thing to mention is the way it does actually fit in with this whole Albert Pike plan for three world wars, the idea that the First World War would be used for the British Empire to take over Palestine, to smash the Ottoman Empire and create a communist regime in Russia, the Second World War to bring communism to China and to create an Israeli state. But anyway, that aside, this is a clip about one of the most fascinating aspects of the Martin Bormann survival tale, which still hasn't really been told, is the two occasions on which the evidence supposedly came out that Bormann most definitely had died on the 1st of May 1945 as he tried to escape the Führer bunker. And as we know, Martin, you and I know, actually, there was a double sent with the British commandos, the idea being to leave this poor unsuspecting double's body in Berlin with the same teeth signature as Bormann. And it's even said in the book, John Ainsworth Davis' book, that Ainsworth Davis saw the real Martin Bormann as this guy died in Berlin, the double. He popped a pill into his mouth to make it look as if he'd also taken poison. And that was then used afterwards as evidence that they'd found poison of some sort in the skull of the dead so-called Bormann. But anyway, I thought I'd just finish with a look at the two occasions in 1972 and in the mid-1990s, mid-late 1990s, when new evidence came to light that supposedly Bormann died in Berlin and didn't survive, wasn't rescued by the British and others, and why that may have been that evidence surfaced at that particular time. Two main occasions where this whole idea of Bormann's body being discovered in Berlin was firstly when Stuart Stephen and Ladislas Farago had this Daily Express front page headline, Martin Bormann alive. Literally within the next week or so, they'd suddenly discovered his body. The second time being upon the publication of the absolutely mind-blowing and brilliant, once you started it, I guarantee you won't stop reading. It's called Op JB, The Last Great Secret of the Second World War. I'm just going to flick to the front cover to see. It's 1996 that was published, and it was literally again a couple of weeks after that was published that we got another load of stuff saying, oh, Bormann's skull has been discovered, blah blah blah. And the other thing to mention is that this marked the beginning of a load of sort of counter wave of books coming out saying, oh, Adolf Hitler has survived, Grey Wolf and the rest of them. Actually they were simply another strategic lie operation in order to divert attention from the fact it was Bormann that survived. Basically, Hitler had run out of steam by the end of the war. You know, he had nothing left. He was on drugs and things to try and keep him going. And he actually wanted to die. It's some kind of, like, sacrificial death. That's the way he saw himself. Bormann, by the way, was the one who was entrusted with his will and brought it to London. The details about that as well.
So, misinformation put out there about Hitler to obscure the truth about Bormann.
So that's part of an interview I did with Richie Allen earlier this week. I'll put up a link to that on our show page thisweek.org.uk. But I'll just leave you to summarise, Martin, what you make of this enormous turnaround that's happened since World War II. I think it's a bit premature to be celebrating VE Day when it looks as if the Western world has taken on rather too many aspects of the whole Nazi empire that they have said that they have vanquished on VE Day.
Yeah, I think it is a very, very significant turning point. The what we're talking about here is the Western power structure, which has been in existence for a long time, constantly mutates, just as dangerous as any virus.
I mean, it's worth pointing out, isn't it, that Edward VIII was a Nazi. He married Morris Simpson, who was a Nazi agent. And actually, over in Lisbon, he prompted the German ambassador to Portugal to start the Blitz on London. So we had a member of the royal family being the man who actually encouraged successfully the Nazi regime to actually start bombing London. So there are quite a lot of senior Nazis within the British establishment, and they were back even in the war.
Well, yeah, the Pinay Circle and others were very definitely pro-Nazi. And I'm afraid you've got plenty of people in power today who've got very similar ideas to the people that were in power then. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. The war will never end against people who are determined to try and dominate human society for their own benefit. And we've got to keep up with it. And we haven't really got an option. We're going to have to do what we can to resist them.
And what do you think of the war memorials that are all over our country now today?
What I think about them is that they are there as a reminder to all of us that the price of freedom is very high, and we've got to be prepared to pay it in every generation.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour councillor for Froome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy on Saturday morning, Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Loch. I'll be back on FM soon, Pat Hart willing. Do please join us for the politics show next Friday afternoon. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.